If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because,
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
Welcome to Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and I'm here with my co-host Shelley Verstrate to talk through both sides of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now with some of the greatest minds in the industry. We are one quarter of the way through the season, y'all, and so it is time to take stock of our teams and players. Who are we excited about? Who are we worried about? Shelley, how are your teams looking one quarter of the way into the season?
You know, some are good, some are bad. Like Tout Wars and some of like my NFBC teams are being pretty good. Like top three, ranked top three, top four. And especially with Tout Wars, I went from the absolute bottom to top five, top six. Within the matter of like 2 weeks. So that's pretty good. It's going okay. I wish it was better. Like there were some teams that were competitive at the beginning of the season and they aren't really competitive now. Like they have dropped down a little bit. So, I mean, I still have a whole lot of work to do, but I'm seeing some improvement from some of my poor teams.
Awesome. Love it. I am actually in a similar boat. I am really doing well in Glarf and in Earth right now. I'm in fourth place in Glarf, but I've been hovering right between like 10th and 17th in the overall in Earth at the moment. And I feel like I have a path there that I can actually thread. My pitching in Glarf has been on point. Every guy that I went with has been excellent. And I have healthy pitchers on the bench, which is just an incredible thing to do. And for those of you who remember from earlier shows, I held on to Paul Skenes, and it's about to be Paul Skenes o'clock, and I'm going to finally get to take advantage of the Skenes pick, and I'm pretty stoked about it. Tout Wars, I actually started out really slow. I mean, I took Spencer Strider second overall there, and then Justin Steele was my SB2, and both of those guys were out. So the fact that I'm currently sitting right between 7th and 9th, depending on the day, and Francisco Lindor is about to get hot, Manny Machado is heating up. Like I feel like, and Kyle Manzardo was also on my bench there, and he's gotten a call up. Like I feel like I'm moving in the right direction in Tout Wars and hoping to get some movement there, but it's still early, but we have enough data where we can make some decisions. And we have brought along one of our friends to help us make those decisions. We're really excited to welcome Kevin Hastings to the show. You know Kevin from his excellent work at Pitcherless, where he's the co-host of one of my favorite podcasts and your favorite podcast, On the Wire. He's also a great fantasy player who won the overall in TGFBI in 2020. Welcome to Fantasy Feud, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. And thank you for having me. This is one of my favorite podcasts out there. So this is an honor. Two of my favorite people in the industry. This is going to be a lot of fun.
We're so stoked you could join us. It's a fun show. And honestly, we're doing things a little bit differently over here. If you're new to the Fantasy Feud, welcome. Please take a minute to rate and review the show. It helps people find us, which is super important since we're still relatively new. I think this is only our 15th episode. But the rules of the road are as follows. This is a debate podcast. So we talk through all of the things that are going on in fantasy baseball right now with a clock and a moderator to keep us on track. Someone will get 3 minutes to make their case, followed by an opponent getting 3 minutes to make their case. There'll be a question and answer for the debaters that can be questions from the moderator or questions from the debaters to each other. And then everybody gets a 1 minute rebuttal. We're going to start doing some work on the Blue Jays here, which, look, I have been so worried about drafting Blue Jays ever since the renovations with the Rogers Center. But Shelley is going to moderate this debate, I believe.
Yeah. The Blue Jays have been like a total, in my opinion, just like a fantasy conundrum because they have changed their dimensions. And then a lot of their players haven't like really reached their potential. I mean, there are numerous players that haven't done that, but, you know, just pinpointing on one is Bo Bichette. He's hitting 195, and he has just one home run through basically a quarter of a season. Are we worried? Should we expect a bounce back? I don't know. Kevin, I'll go to you since you're our guest.
I'm worried about Bo Bichette, and it's a combination of things. The ballpark changing last season, we saw how that affected a lot of the Toronto hitters, and in a negative way, and that is part of it. But more so, he's just not hitting the ball hard so far this season. Lowest hard hit rate of his career, lowest barrel rate by far. His Statcast page is completely blue, other than whiff percentage, strikeout percentage, and speed. So we know he doesn't strike out, and he's got some speed. But what really intrigues me is when I look at his Statcast page spray chart. There is nothing being pulled, especially to the outfield, right? And if you go back and look at his 2022 spray chart, when he bounced back after a similar slow start, his spray chart was all over the field. It was a nice, even spread, and a lot of his home runs were pulled fly balls, especially now. You had Jason Collette here a couple of weeks ago talking about this. We don't think it's the baseball, but we think there's more universal standards for the humidors at each stadium. So the oppo power just isn't there for these guys. And that's what worries me, because it really appears to me like this is a concerted effort. His strikeout rate's down. With already low strikeout rate, and it's down. So I think he is choosing contact over power here. At least it appears so far. And even if he makes a concerted effort to change this, that takes time. It's not something he can just switch overnight. It'll take him some time to get comfortable if he does indeed realize that maybe I should be trying to pull the ball more often again. So I am worried, at least in the short term, because I think even if he makes these decisions, then it can take a bit. And the other concern is it due to a nagging underlying injury we don't know about? So I'm a little worried about Bo Bichette here.
You know, go ahead, Shelly.
Oh, no, you go ahead, Sarah.
I just jumped right in. I have a tendency to do that on occasion. My bad. I don't disagree with anything that Kevin said. I think that when I look at Bo Bichette and his 15-game rolling WOBA chart, like, you can see that how he recovered his 2022 season is the outlier. It's not the norm. It's this like massive spike in a sea that sort of vacillates around various things. But there is some good news in that 15-game rolling WOBA chart, and it is that the nadir of that chart, the lowest point of it, is a career norm low point. It's not like what we're seeing is some out of the ordinary slump from Bo Bichette that he has never had before. This is a thing that he has dealt with before in small samples and come back from. So if you have Bo Bichette right now, my suggestion to you is to hold, because you have ridden it through the worst. And if it gets better, you can at least benefit a tiny bit from the bounce back. I was fortunate enough in 2022 in Tout Wars, I made a trade for Bo Bichette. I traded some pitching for Bo Bichette right at his lowest point, and then I got the benefit of just the bounce back, right? And so that actually pushed me in Tout Wars up into second place. That was one of the best trades I've made in the last few seasons. I took a risk. I traded a pitcher who was dealing at the time, Julio Urias, for Bo Bichette. Like, that was... I was potentially setting myself back on pitching, but it worked out. So my inclination right now in the places I have Bo Bichette is to hold, but I think Kevin's right. The Rogers Center dimensions are problematic, and we've seen it not just with Bo Bichette. We've seen it with Matt Chapman. We've seen it with Vlad Guerrero. Like, a lot of the Blue Jays hitters that we expect to be sluggers are not slugging, and that's a park problem. It's probably also a ball problem. It's probably also a pull power problem. I would love to see Bo generate some loud contact. I do think there is good news in the strikeout rate, though. Like, I see him, his strikeout rate is the lowest of his career. So he is trying to make something happen. He's only striking out 14.9% of the time. If he can just get his swing back to where he makes slightly harder contact, I think it'll pay off. And finally, you're not getting zero value from him at the moment. He is running a little bit, right? Like, he has 3 stolen bases right now, which is on pace for more than what he's done in previous seasons. He's not probably going to be like that 20-20, 30-20 guy ever again, but he is running a little bit. The sprint speed looks up, so he's trying to make up for it in other ways. I think you have to just hold on here and hope that he's going to keep running to try to provide value while he's struggling through this cold streak, and that the contact is going to come.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, because a 55 weighted runs created plus seems egregiously low when it comes to Bo Bichette. But Sarah, I just kind of like want to like put something to you. He's not pulling the ball. Like, last year, he was pulling the ball 27%. This year, he's pulling it 22%. Do you think just with the Blue Jays offensive struggles as a whole, do you think that he's just trying to put the ball more into play, so maybe we won't see that power?
Well, I think that he's probably in between on his approach right now. And what I mean by that is, it's not so much that he's trying anything to like help the offense, and so he's hitting the ball poorly. I think that what I see when I look at his Statcast page, I see a 223 BABIP, which is going to normalize at some point in time. Like, you don't have a BABIP that's that out of line with your career norm when you've got a little bit of speed and you make a ton of contact, unless something wonky is going on. So I think that probably stabilizes and pushes that WRC plus back into the average range or slightly above average, right? On the pool side thing, though, I really just think it's more that he's not impacting the baseball the way that he wants to. And I he is not like Seiya Suzuki, so I'm not using him and Seiya as like comps for each other, but I watched Seiya go through something similar last year with the Chicago Cubs, where all the contact was bad. He was couldn't figure out, like, oh, it's a fastball, it's a curveball, and he would like try to hit it, and it was never a hard hit, right? And when he pulled out of that, he was immediately like the guy we all expected him to be. And so I think that Bichette is probably similarly in between. But I admit that if you used like a third or fourth round draft pick on him right now, you're not getting your value on that. And that is scary. My only thing to tell you, don't be the person that trades Bo Bichette at this moment in time. It can only work out badly for you.
All right, Kevin, what do you think about that?
I get it. I agree. I am not saying we should cut bait with Bo Bichette, but I am worried. The bright spot for me is his line drive percentage is extremely low for him, and line drive percentage has a ton of variance, but players do tend to regress towards their career average, and he's down at only his line drive percentage right now is half of what it is for his career, so that will regress back, and then that leads to more hits, higher batting average, more runs scored, all of that good stuff. But I'm still concerned about the lack of power until he starts pulling the bar more.
I don't disagree with you on the power and the pull issue. I will say that I just added the pull rate to the WOBA chart that I was looking at. And it does, again, it's not a career low. Like, this is something that has happened before. It happened at the start of 2023. It happened right before his surge in 2022. And it happened in that down period in 2022. So you just got to pray that there's a bounce back coming, because the skills are too good from a contact perspective and from like a speed and what he can do perspective to believe that there's something structural he can't fix. And God, I hope it's not the ball or the field, because those are structural things you can't fix.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So I don't disagree with anything that either of you have brought up. I do agree things are going to get better, especially with that line drive rate being so low. I think that comes back. Love the reference to the rolling charts. That's a good way to bring us back down to earth when we're looking at these things. And I hope you're right, because Bo Bichette is one of the fun players in baseball to watch. I'm a baseball fan first, Royals fan second, fantasy baseball player third. It's baseball's more fun when Bo Bichette is performing well.
I love that you brought that up, because baseball is more fun when all of these guys are performing well. Like, there is no player, not even Cardinals players or Yankees players, that I want to do poorly. I might want them to do poorly when they're playing the Cubs or the Red Sox, but generally, I want players to succeed. I want to watch incredible feats on the field. And I think Bo has some of those left in his tank. I don't think that this is something that we need to be terribly worried about right now. Now, if we get to Memorial Day and these numbers look the same, that's a different conversation. Like at Memorial Day, something, I would then start to wonder if this is an injury or something else. All right. First debate out of the way. Always good stuff here on Fantasy Feud. We're going to move on. So one of my favorite tools this season is the Fangraphs player rater, just sort of getting an idea of who's hot, who's not, what's going on, what type of auction value you've gotten from players today. And one of the things that I've been looking at for a couple of weeks there now, William Contreras is the fourth most valuable hitter in baseball, according to the Fangraphs player rater. He has been outstanding. And to be clear, that is not fourth best catcher. That is fourth best overall hitter in the entire sport, which is incredible. If you took him in like the fifth, sixth, or seventh round, you are getting some awesome value for your William Contreras pick. He's flashing 328, 406, 507 with five home runs. Even if he slows down a bit, that's an unbelievable value for your catcher. Is this a breakout or just a hot streak? And Shelley, I will start with you.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to be a negative Nancy here. I think that it's a hot streak. While I think that Wilson Contreras will probably be a top two catcher, maybe even the top catcher. But going forward, it just seems that this rate that he's doing seems over his head. I mean, he's the power seems over his head. And maybe when, you know, Yelich comes back or something like that, like someone comes back, maybe he will go back down the lineup and maybe he won't be looking to do everything all at once because he has Yelich there. I don't know. I just feel that this is a little bit of a mirage. Like what he is doing seems so far in a way more than whatever anyone ever projected for him to do. He might still be the number one catcher, number two catcher, whatever. But I just like this power output is absolutely insane. I mean, I'm loving it. It's very exciting, but I just don't see how he can keep up with it.
You know, Contreras is exceeding expectations is sort of my specialty over here. Kevin, what do you see from William Contreras? Is this a hot streak or a breakout?
I love William Contreras, and I think this is a continuation of the breakout that we began to see last year when he was the number one catcher in fantasy baseball for the 2023 season. There's another metric, Sarah, where William Contreras is fourth in all of Major League Baseball. One of my favorite metrics that is easily found on the pitcher list player pages, hard contact percentage. I prefer it over hard hit percentage because it's based on per plate appearance. So it stabilizes more quickly. We get a bigger sample size. So that is the case. He's fourth in all of Major League Baseball, not just catcher, but fourth in all of baseball in hard contact percentage as well, hitting a ball 95 miles an hour or over in 39% of his plate appearances and walking at 11%. So 50% of the time William Contreras comes to the plate, he does something good. He hits the ball hard or draws a walk. Love that. He might drop a spot or two in the lineup when a couple of guys come back because he's on pace to exceed that 611 plate appearances we saw last season. That would be absolutely crazy. I think that probably does come back a little bit and we see something more at the end, a little over the 600. I don't think we're going to approach the 700 plate appearances like he's on pace for right now. But the power was there in 2022. We were actually a little disappointed for everything he did so amazing last season. We were a little disappointed in the 17 home runs. So I see him getting to the 20 to 25. I don't see him hitting 20 in less than 400 plate appearances like 2022, but I can see the 20 to 25 home runs. The batting average is going to come down. He's always ran high BABIPs, but it's exceptionally high at the moment at 390. That'll come down, so he's not going to hit 328, but you know, projections have him in that 280 range with another 15 home runs that gets him to 20. That's what I expected coming into the season, and I don't see any reason why this won't continue.
Kevin, you hit on something there that I have been really fascinated by with William, and that is that hard hit rate that he has. It's over 50% right now, and he is in the 98th percentile for hard hit rate. I think he's like the 97th percentile for average exit velocity. He is seeing the ball well and absolutely crushing it at every single opportunity. I wonder, and look, the league is going to adapt to him at some point in time. You can't run this hot all of the time without somebody finding a hole and exposing it. But do you think that this just may be where his peak powers lie? He's only 26 years old. We've only seen four seasons of William Contreras. And part of me wonders if this is just who he's maturing to be.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Like I said, that power did come down quite a bit from 2022 in 2023. And if we get just a little bit of a bump back to the 20 to 25 home runs over a full 600 plate appearances rather than the 376 that he hit the 20 in 2022, that's more than okay. The other thing that I almost forgot to add here, because he's hitting so close to the top of the lineup and the team has been performing well, with what he's projected with the rest of the season, we're looking at 90 runs and 90 RBI out of a catcher. That is insanely valuable to a fantasy team.
It is insanely valuable to a fantasy team and kind of incredible. I mean, looking at his Fangraphs page, this is a 45 plus future value prospect. And it just goes to show you that future value grades are not promises, right? Like, players can and do exceed those all of the time. I think it's interesting that William Contreras was not really a prospect that people were like, oh yeah, he's going to be outstanding best catcher in baseball. He was a bat first catcher that people were like, I don't know, this might work, this might not. I mean, the Braves traded him. They decided Sean Murphy was a better bet, and right now that seems like a silly thing that the Braves had done. Shelley, when you look at William Contreras's approach, some of the numbers that Kevin was talking about, specifically that increased walk rate, that decreased strikeout rate, which is a continuation of last season, what do you think the ceiling is? I think we all agree that the ceiling is not what we're seeing right now, but where do you think that ceiling lives?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the strikeout rate will increase just a bit and the walk rate will decrease a bit just based on what he did as a prospect. Honestly, he has like blown my mind from what he was in the Atlanta organization. And just, Kevin, I know you're a Kansas City Royals fan. I mean, honestly, what he's doing, this is screaming Salvador Perez. He's playing every day. He's catching DH. Like, this is like prime Salvador Perez output. And I never would have put this on William Contreras.
Yeah, I love that. And if he is going to continue a career similar to Salvi, then we're looking at production for another eight seasons. That to me makes him the number one catcher in dynasty leagues, right? That I don't think get talked about enough on some of the podcasts that don't concentrate on dynasty leagues. There's many out there that do concentrate on dynasty leagues, but something we don't bring up enough. I mean, in a dynasty league, William Contreras would be my number one catcher right now.
Honestly, just kind of like what the Brewers are doing and just kind of like their makeup and kind of like the catching prospects that they have coming up, which isn't that great, outside of Jefferson Rojas, which injured his shoulder. So it might be like another year. Yeah, I think we have another year or two of complete like William Contreras, you know, playing time. I have definitely, you know, tilted off my anti-stance. But yeah, this year, I think it's going to come down just a little bit. But yeah, William Contreras is probably pretty good.
To be clear, the rolling charts suggest that William Contreras is already stabilizing back to his norm over the last couple of weeks. But it's still fun to watch. And, you know, as the foremost Wilson Contreras fan, the William and Wilson comparison is truly quite good. They're both exceeding expectations in lots of similar ways. And one of the things I find curious before we go to these final rebuttals, they tend to have the same like skill improvement at the same time. Like both of them cut their strikeout rates about 7% last season. I have to wonder if they're like sharing tips or working out together in the off season, like, hey, I'm going to try this. You should try this. Okay. And like, how fun would that be if the Contreras are just like teaching each other great tricks? Kevin, you can have our first rebuttal 1 minute to go on William Contreras.
Yeah. I don't think there's much left to say here. Once again, I buy into almost everything he's doing, with the caveat I do not expect 328 batting average the rest of the way. Not even 300, right? But that 280-ish that the projections, most of them have him in that range. I agree with that. But I think the counting stats are going to continue to be there. The home runs, the RBI, the runs, even a handful of stolen bases here and there. Nice little bonus that we get from Contreras. And a 280 batting average from a catcher is amazing. So we're not going to scoff at that either.
Shelly, you got anything you want to rebut, or have we just sold you on the William Contreras side?
I mean, I'm totally on the William Contreras side, but definitely if you are in a league that is an active trading league, and I know that those leagues are very far and in between, because most of the leagues that I'm in are, I mean, they're no one really likes to trade, and it kind of bums me out just a little bit. But anyway, if you are in an active league that likes to trade, and if you can trade Wilson Contreras to get another catcher and some other upgrade there, then yes, I would do it. But otherwise, just kind of hold pat, but expect just a slight little downgrade throughout your weekly production or your roto production.
Love that. And I want to highlight one thing that Kevin said before we go to a quick break, which is the plate appearances from William Contreras is also just gold. Like most catchers don't have that type of plate appearance. Salvador Perez is a huge exception. Sean Murphy, when he was with the A's, was an exception. Like there are just not that many guys who teams are letting get to that number of plate appearances. So if you can get that from a top tier catcher, double down on that. We are going to go to a quick break. We have a handful of debates coming up that you will not want to miss. We've got some closers to talk about. We've got some outfielders to talk about. Of course, we have our love it or leave it. But first, we have to pay the bills.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
And we're back. So one of the things that I think we talk about in fantasy baseball circles all of the time is, how do you invest in closers? Which ones are the right ones? It felt like at the start of this draft season, there were so many closers to pick from. The tier one went on forever. And all of a sudden, it didn't feel that way anymore by the end of draft season. Kevin is going to moderate this debate.
Yeah, sweet. So yeah, you titled this Closer Chaos, Sarah. I love it. So, and two of the top tier closers as they were drafted are in the top 50 pitcher values by the Plater Raider at the moment. Clay Holmes is also in the top 50. He was kind of borderline towards the bottom of the top tier. And then Kirby Yates, who did not have a job during draft season, is in that top 50 as well. That's what can happen when you land a closing role and you still haven't given up a run. those have been there, but then we have guys like, you know, Kyle Finnegan much later in drafts is tied for the league lead in saves. Mason Miller is right there, where there was a little bit of worry towards the end of draft season that he'd kind of fallen out of us what we'd been told he may close, and then he wasn't, and then he got the job back. So he's been a nice late round or even fab pickup in some leagues for many guys. So, but Sarah, let's start with you. How do you attack the closer position or the saves category in drafts. And how's that working out for you so far this season?
Oh, well, how it's working out for me so far this season is way different than the ideal world that I would like to advocate for. Hey, but I will answer both questions. So closers are the hardest part of early draft rounds for me. You're usually taking your first closer in like round four. You're probably taking another closer somewhere in like round 8 to 10. And you're doing that because, especially if you're in a competition with an overall, like there's just no way to guarantee that you're going to get those saves later. And it sort of feels like throwing darts and hoping that you get the right guy, right? Like if you picked Devin Williams, as I did in Glarf this season, that was wrong, incorrect. Like you go back to zero, like you get zero saves there until July. And if you're willing to hang on to Devin Williams, which I was not in an NFBC league, well, good luck to you. You know, if you pick the right dart late in a draft, like a Kyle Finnegan, because, and you probably weren't enthusiastic about that, right? Like Hunter Harvey was one of my most drafted guys because I was just sure Hunter Harvey was coming for Kyle Finnegan's job. And whoops, I'm wrong. Kyle Finnegan's like the 51st rated pitcher overall. And Hunter Harvey doesn't look like he's coming for Kyle Finnegan's job anytime in the near future. It is such a random assortment of dudes that you are picking from. And I sort of feel like it's almost like drawing a lottery ticket. It's not quite the odds of the lottery, but like your chances are 1 in 7 that the top closer that you're drafting is going to actually return the value of that draft pick in the fourth round. Most of them are going to return subpar value from where that draft pick is. And you're giving up on so much at that point, right? Like in the fourth round, William Contreras was available. He's the fourth best bat in baseball right now, right? Like there's pitchers who are available there. Like a guy like Shota Imanaga was available there. Look what he's doing right now. Like all of those guys went later than those closers, and saves and the scarcity of them pushes those closers up. So the strategy that I really like to deploy, and sometimes I do it better than other, I pick one guy in that top tier, either the top guy that I'm most certain about or the last guy in the tier. And then I try to pick one guy in the second tier. And then I pick one random dart at the end. Sometimes that random dart is a backup for one of the two guys I picked above. So for example, this year, and it's not working out very well, Kevin, thank you for asking. I have a lot of Adbert Alzolay that went very terribly. I have a decent amount of Jose Alvarado going less terribly, but the Phillies bullpen situation is always sort of like closer by committee. And I probably should have been a little bit more suspect of that. I have a handful. I have a league where I have Jordan Romano and Craig Kimbrell. That's going a little bit better. But in order to make that work with Romano starting the season on the IL, I had to pick a backup for Romano later, right? Which when I was using multiple draft picks there. I feel good about the places where I drafted Carlos Estevez. I feel like that one worked out pretty well, but that was a risky pick too. We didn't know Robert Stevenson was going to miss the entire season. So I think you want to diversify so that you're not doubling down on, say, that top tier of closers, and then God forbid you miss on both of them, and now you've given up a fourth round pick and a sixth round pick, and you didn't get any of those bats or any of those other arms. And I also feel like this is the spot where I'm weakest. This is also the spot, in my opinion, where it's hardest to make it up in FAB, because everyone else needs those saves too. And the second we all know a guy is going to get saves, everybody's ready to pop 20, 25% of their FAB budget, and you're just hoping that it pays off.
Yeah, that's a great point on the acquisition cost, whether it be in a draft or in FAB for drafting these guys. It's really easy to say, why spend an early draft pick on Devin Williams when you can draft Kyle Finnegan 15 rounds later, but everybody in your draft is going to want Kyle Finnegan at that point, whether they've drafted closers yet or not. So how does this work out for you typically, Shelly?
Honestly, typically, it's gone the same way as what Sarah was saying. I have always had trouble drafting closers, and I may have considered effort this draft season to draft closers. But you know, I drafted the injured closers. But just looking back, I think that drafting early closers and the top closers, you know, like Josh Hader, Emmanuel Clase, I don't mind. Even I know that Hader is kind of down right now, but it's really because the Astros are surprisingly down. I didn't expect them to run away with the AL West division, but I didn't expect them to be, honestly, like one of the worst teams in the league. So I expected him to have more saves. But just going with a top tier closer, I think, is a good way. Yes, you will miss out on the William Contreras's and other position players that are available. But when it comes to closers, there's only one closer. There is three outfielders. There is how many ever infielders, how many ever, you know, whatever. How many ever positions to field whatever you need. But you only have one closer. So I really do think that trying to pinpoint that closer is extremely important, especially with roto leagues, maybe not head-to-head leagues because saves are really fluky in those types of leagues. But in roto leagues, it's extremely important to just try to find someone. Yes, you could just totally just trip over yourself and not find a closer this year because there has been a lot of top closers that have failed. But last year, closers were really, you know, kind of consistent and reliable, which seems strange to say, but they're really reliable. So as long as you have like those top tier guys, I think that it is fine taking a gamble on at least trying to secure that one roto category that no one else can produce.
Yeah, I tend to agree with both of you here. In general, last year, everything was consistent. That was something we hadn't seen in several years, and now we're not seeing it again this year. It does appear 2023 was the outlier in the fact of many closers for a high percentage of teams being pretty stable. But I think usually the top closers do perform for us. The risk is just injury. My question for you, Sarah, is when you are choosing which top end closer that you would like to target, or which group of top end closers that you would hope to get one of, how much do you take the team concept into consideration? Because if we look at the leaderboard, we have five guys with 11 saves right now. Class A for Cleveland, Finnegan for Washington, Helsley for St. Louis, Clay Holmes for the New York Yankees, Robert Suarez for the San Diego Padres. None of these teams have won over 19 games. Now, a 19 and 16 record, or wherever that would be at this point, is a nice record. But these aren't the teams that have over 20 wins so far on the season. So what are we looking for in team context when you're choosing these closers during draft season?
It's a great point, and I actually think this is a place where we fall down as an analytics community all of the time, because saves require the opportunity for a save and a team that can win the game, not by a very small number of runs. And a few years ago, I made the decision that I'm okay with a closer on a bad team. I'm okay with a closer on a middling team. I'm a little skeptical of a closer on a top team, because a lot of those teams are winning their games by so many runs that they're not generating save opportunities, right? Like over at Bleed Cubby Blue in 2016, we used to joke that the Cubs were playing mess with the closer. We didn't use the word mess with. We used a different word. I decided to edit that out for, because this is a Nick Pollock production and he doesn't, but y'all can guess like what word might go there instead of mess with. The Cubs just kept winning games by adding on runs in the seventh and eighth inning, and so many runs that the closer was not going to get a save in that situation. That was a historically good Cubs team, and they didn't generate that many save opportunities. So I actually think there's a sweet spot for saves that is somewhere within the 20th to 80th percentile of teams. Are you going to get that many saves from the Chicago White Sox? Probably not. They're really, really terrible right now. Are you going to get that many saves from the Miami Marlins? I'm not sure. Like, and they don't seem to have figured that out. Like, there's a reason that AJ Puck's going to probably take that job from Canner Scott and hopefully go back to giving you some value for the draft pick that you got for AJ Puck, but who knows? However, the Cardinals are a perfect example of a team that is in last place, that is playing close games where they have a guy and the guy has a job. So I think the most important thing with a closer is opportunity. And opportunity means different things than what we think it means. The Dodgers and Braves are not always giving you save opportunities. The Padres are giving you a lot of save opportunities. So you need close games, a pitcher who can close them down, and finally, the last ingredient, you need a manager who is willing to give the dude the job. And, you know, I mentioned Albert Alzolay earlier, like Craig Counsell kind of played fast and loose in spring training about, we don't know, we'll see, we just have to get 27 outs, I actually think that might have gotten in Albert's head a little bit, like, and he kind of is trying too hard, and now he's messed with his tunneling, and now he's not the closer or anywhere close to the closer because he has to figure out how to stop giving up home runs to left-handed hitters like he did for a year and a half earlier in his starting pitching career, right? And that's how fast the closer market can shift. I mean, Hector Neris is walking more guys than he strikes out, but he's getting outs at the end of baseball games, so he gets saves. That is bananas, but that is the way the cookie crumbles with the closer role. So you need a manager who's willing to call it a guy's job. You need a team that's playing close enough games that it matters. And frankly, at that point, the Washington Nationals are as good as anyone else.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Shelley, how do you feel about the team context when you're drafting closers? And does that affect if you are going to wait, then when we're looking at middle rounds for closers, does that come into play there as well?
I kind of got lucky with picking up Kyle Finnegan and James MacArthur late. But again, like that's extremely luck. Any fantasy manager can do what I did. I was just like, let me look at bad teams and just go with their, who I think is the best closer or who I think the best closer is. And maybe that's a good way to go. I don't know. This has been like the hardest part for me as a fantasy manager to figure out, like, it's the biggest struggle for me. And surprisingly, I have been okay with, you know, how things have gone so far. But again, it's because I got Finnegan and MacArthur, and I drafted Craig Kimbrough before he got a little bit of hype within the community, right? So while I will say that maybe waiting on closers is okay, still push the gas pedal and get those closers that you feel confident with, because the majority of the time they will give you those saves. Like, we still think that, you know, the Braves closer is going to give you saves. We think Josh Hader is going to give you more than three saves throughout the entire month, right? So we think that these particular closers are going to catch up at some point. Just their teams are just not giving them the opportunities. But again, it's been a month and a half. Give them some time. Honestly, I really do think that, I mean, what I'm planning to do, you know, next year when I draft is prioritize closers, because there is like one guy who can give you that one category. So as much as it's going to hurt to take a closer in the third or fourth round, I am okay with that, even if it's not looking good so far.
Yeah, I tend to agree. When I first started making this transition to drafting closers earlier, and I agree with both of you, typically one of the top tier, another one a tier or two lower, and then take another shot or two late. That is typically what I do. And the reason I began to do that in the first place was I realized if I have good closers and two of them, then that's all I have to put in my starting lineup out of my nine pitchers in leagues where we start nine pitchers of any variety, right? I can throw seven starters or six starters and a long reliever to get me more innings. I don't have to throw a third or even a fourth guy out there sometime hoping that I'm getting a save or two for any one of these four guys that don't have a, you know, more of a hold on the role. That's the reason I started doing it. And it has worked out when I don't draft the guy that ends up being injured for most of the season. So I've continued to do so, but that was a big reasoning for me. Sarah, anything you'd like to rebut here before we move on?
I mean, the only thing I will say is that this is definitely working out better for Shelly this season than me. And Shelly, maybe next year in draft season, I need to see your list of closers and compare it with my list of closers, because clearly I am putting my faith in some of the wrong guys. I mean, I admit, I think that my Cubs expertise got in the way of me seeing how questionable Adbert's hold on that role could be. That was a little bit of like, I made a fan mistake because I love him and I wanted that to be a thing, and it should be a thing, but it's not. So that was definitely a little bit, I will take the L on that. Don't let your fandom get in the way of who you spec on for closers, but it's hardly just Alzolay, right? Like, I think that Jordan Romano is a great example. Like, people were scared away from drafting Jordan Romano. I took the price drop on Jordan Romano and decided that I would just take like a Yimi Garcia really late in the draft and try to get those saves there and like bank those for later. That was a much smarter decision on my part. So I think that you got to look for the guys who have a job, the teams that will have those opportunities, and don't let your fandom get in the way.
Shelly, you have anything to add before we move on?
Sarah, your fandom is great. I have Christopher Morel pretty much everywhere. So thank you. So yes, fandom can come into play, but sometimes it comes back to bite you in the butt. That's all I gotta say.
Oh, look, Christopher Morel, like, his K rate is down 10% this year, y'all, and his walk rate is up to like 12%. And he's going on one of his burners right now where he just hits home runs all of the time. So put Christopher Morel back in your lineup if you took him out.
Yep, that's right.
One thing to add in support of drafting early closers and drafting closers on good teams is it seems to me that those are the teams that allow their closer to pitch the top of the ninth in a tie ball game, which leads to more wins for our teams as well.
That's a really great point. I hadn't thought about that. So you're double dipping on the two hardest stats, right? Because saves and wins are the stats that, like, that player cannot really control when they're going to get them. They didn't put the runs on the board to have it be a 3-run lead instead of a 6-run lead. And they didn't make the decision of who was going to come out or come in when. That's a great point, Kevin. All right, moving right along here on Fantasy Feud. We've got an outfielder debate for you, and I think I'm moderating this one, so I'll introduce the whole thing. The Rays are at it again. Johnny DeLuca has played in all four games since returning off the injured list. He has taken playing time away from a white-hot Richie Palacios, who you may remember from previous episodes of this show, when Josh Lowe returned Monday night. It seems like a good problem for Tampa Bay. They have four excellent offensive outfielders. But the problem for fantasy managers is, which one of these guys do you want to have on your roster for the rest of the season? Who do you got, Johnny DeLuca or Richie Palacios? And Kevin, I am going to start this debate with you as our guest.
Yeah, I just think that I don't have a whole lot of interest in either one of them anymore. I think Johnny DeLuca was somebody I did like in draft season, specifically draft and hold draft season. When we're drafting 50 rounds and we can't pick up throughout the season, that's our team. I did foresee that he would be getting some playing time at some point this season. Richie Palacios was performing very well, as you said, white hot leading up to this point. But as much as in over the past year or two, I've kind of started to push back on the narrative that we don't want very many Tampa players. They platoon everybody. They've kind of settled into, they will have guys that do get a larger majority of playing time than just the strong side of a strict platoon. So I think some of the Tampa players have been undervalued. However, in this situation, as you said, Sarah, We got a whole lot of outfielders here. We also have infielders that are trying to get in, and that clogs up the DH as well. And Harold Ramirez just keeps hitting over 300, so they'll leave him in the DH spot. Jose Siri has not started the last two games. And in fact, that is where we have seen DeLuca in center field, both of those games in Siri's spot. I have Siri on a couple of teams. I'm really worried about his playing time now. I know he wasn't performing great, and then the two-game suspension after the being involved in the brawl with Milwaukee. I kind of thought that might have been what would get him going a little bit, and I was hopeful. Well, now he's losing playing time too, so that may prolong how long it takes him to get things going again. So I really am kind of have a blah feeling about the entire Tampa outfield now. This is, you know, Josh Lowe back off the IL, as you mentioned. He's going to be in right field, especially against righties. We haven't seen them face a lefty since he's been back. But yeah, this is really clogged up out there. Arozarena's, in spite of his troubles, He'll get his playing time. They'll let him work his way out of it. So, you know, we're looking at three or four guys for two spots and a DH that's being clogged up by Harold Ramirez. I'm kind of out on all these guys, unfortunately.
You know, Harold Ramirez is just the bane of existence of so many fantasy managers right now. No offense to Harold Ramirez, who I'm sure is a great dude, but man, can we get some playing time for some of the guys that we have on our fantasy rosters outside of mono leagues, please? Tampa Bay, Shelley, who do you got rest of season, DeLuca and Richie Palacios?
Yeah, it's actually like really funny because I was talking with my husband about this because he has Richie Palacios and he was like really excited that I told him to pick him up, and he's been, ecstatic. You know, he's been really, really great. And so he wasn't starting against a right-hander. I'm like, why do they have Harold Ramirez in the DH? On Monday night, and then he went 4-for-4, and I'm like, okay, Tampa knows a whole lot more than me. He goes 4-for-4, but anyway, honestly, I really do like Richie Palacios, and I do like Johnny DeLuca. I was both in on them during DC season, which is usually, you know, before spring training starts. So, you know, December, January, that type of thing. We have like 50 rounds. We draft, you know, 50 rounds of players. There's no pickups. I was really big on both of these guys. I think that at some point, Tampa will realize that they need this offense, and they really do. They're like the worst in the AL. AL East currently within record. And yeah, they probably need both of these guys. No offense to Harold Ramirez and his 4-for-4 night last night to shut me up. That both of these guys, I think, could be productive. If you have a deep enough bench, I don't mind rostering both of these until you kind of see where Tampa is going to go. I agree with Kevin that Tampa is extremely fluid, right? We have no idea what they're going to do. But both these players have performed, and Tampa needs that performance because, again, they are last in the AL East. At some point, you know, water will rise, right? And both of these guys, I do think, can find their, you know, everyday playing time. In Tampa's lineup. So I think it might be a hard kind of hold when it comes to Richie Palacios because Johnny DeLuca has been on fire since he came off the IL. But I think both of these guys in, you know, 12 to 15 team size leagues are great, honestly, roster holds.
Awesome. I mean, I think, Shelley, I'm going to start with my first question for you. The problem I always have with the Rays is I want to hold a lot of their talented guys, too. And then their playing time never manifests. Right. I mean, how many times have I been burned by Vidal Brujan and admittedly he had struggles and whatnot. But like, sure, it seems like every time I'm interested in a Tampa Bay person, Josh Lowe, when he first came up, I'm like, yes, let's go Josh Lowe. And then he can't get everyday playing time and then he gets hurt. And then it's like, Yandy Diaz, I used to like be super into, and then I had to be out on, and then I had to come back. At what point is this like, the team is never going to make it possible for us to invest in their young talent because they just don't treat their talent the way we need them to for fantasy purposes?
It's extremely a frustrating hold, to be honest, because what if Josh Lowe struggles against lefties after he comes off the IL? I think that, you know, the Rays could just pull the rug underneath of him and just put Luca and Palacios back in there and just totally change up everything. But because the Rays is so much of a moving carpet, try to get as many good players that you know can hit, because obviously they can see that they can hit too. And at some point, the cream is going to rise to the top. So I'm just kind of holding on guys who I have seen hit extremely well. And I see that, I mean, Richie Palacios is hitting second before Josh Lowe comes back, before he came back. And I just think that's bonkers that, you know, he was on the bench on Monday. But so it's more of like, hold what you got and just trust with the talent, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And Kevin, there are so many talented players in the Rays system. It's one of the things that they do super well. It's why they're always on like the top of the leaderboards in terms of projected Fangraphs WAR and all of these other types of things. And they are very crafty about deploying that advantage as they see fit. If you had to pick between rostering a Richie Palacios or a Johnny DeLuca, which of these guys would you want to roster and why?
So I think I would go with Palacios. The reason being, projections have him for a 15 to 25 point advantage in batting average, with everything else looking pretty similar. That neither one of them are projected for a whole lot of plate appearances. I believe that they both of these guys can get more than they're projected for rest of season. But they're counting stats very similar in projections, with Palacios having the advantage in projected batting average, not by a lot, but by a little bit here. I think it's also interesting to point out, you know, that I brought up Harold Ramirez, you agreed with me. Harold Ramirez has performed so far this season right in line with the projections of Palacios and DeLuca. And his projections the rest of the way, very similar as well, with a big batting average advantage. So the right answer might be, when you can't beat them, join them. And we should be rostering Harold Ramirez instead of either one of these guys.
Oh, that's a fascinating point. I mean, I hate it, but you're not wrong.
Exactly, we hate it.
I'm probably like, that's a cheap fab ad too. Shelley, do you have a 1 minute rebuttal?
Yeah, honestly, just try to get Richie Palacios or Johnny DeLuca on your team. Harold Ramirez was like a late DC ad for me, and has come out, you know, has performed for me in a couple of really nasty weeks. But anyway, I think both of these outfielders are really interesting. It just really seems that they're on Tampa and they don't get everyday playing time.
Fair enough. Kevin, your 1 minute rebuttal.
Yeah, I think the big thing here is we have not seen Tampa face a left-handed starter in several days since a lot of these changes have come about. So this is, it almost feels like a cop-out answer, but I think we need to see what the lineup looks like against a couple of lefties, and I'll take the one of the two that's getting the most playing time.
All right. Great debate. I have a lot to think about in terms of which of these outfielders I'm going to roster in the leagues where I need an outfielder. We are going to take one last quick break for our sponsors. On the flip side, we have a couple more debates. We also have our Love It or Leave It stick round.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Okay, I have the moderation duties for this debate as well, and it's kind of a fun one. Michael Massey of the Kansas City Royals has been hitting really well recently, 370, 393, 778 since the end of April. For the rest of the season, would you rather take your chances with a guy like Jeff McNeil, who's a former batting champ and has all of that proven track record, or are you ready to dive in on Team Massey? Shelley, I will start with you.
Yeah, I'm going to be just kind of like, you know, kind of like falling into like the known production. And Jeff McNeil, he plays second base, he plays outfield. So there's two position eligibilities that Massey does not have. And while McNeil has been kind of slow out the gate, he's hitting 231, 311, 306. As of, you know, a Monday, the May 6th, I still think that he is the better safe bet. Maybe I'm like totally wrong. Like I think that he is okay. I think the Mets are starting to get into their groove. Like they're starting to win more games. I think McNeil will get back into the groove kind of like a Whit Merrifield. I will go back to a old school Royal kind of guy. So yeah, I think McNeil can get back to a much better average than he's currently projected to. And then when it comes to Massey, I'm just like, I don't know. I never expected what he is currently doing from him. So I'm like, let me just give me the safe guy over the maybe young volatile guy.
Glad you brought up Whit Merrifield, who I dropped 2 weeks ago because he was losing playing time. And I didn't see any reason to hang on to Whit Merrifield. I needed some pitching. And so I did that. And now Trey Turner's out for 6 weeks and Whit Merrifield has a clear path to some playing time and seems to be swinging a hot stick. So good job past me. You never know what's going to happen in fantasy baseball, friends. It's one of those unpredictable sports. And that's part of why we love it. Kevin, who's your guy between Massey and McNeil?
Well, I'm going with Michael Massey here, but it's not as much of a homer pick as many might think when I'm supporting the Kansas City Royal. This is more of a, I've never been a big Jeff McNeil fan. And this goes all the way back to his 2019 season when he hit 318 with 23 home runs. And I didn't buy into it. So that offseason, one of the first articles I ever wrote in this industry was for Lenny Melnick, LennyMelnick.com back at the time. I stumbled across the fact that of Jeff McNeil's 23 home runs that season, like 14 of them were on the first pitch of the at-bat. And that sent me down a rabbit hole. Even the guys with over 40 home runs that season, I think that was Soler, his 48 home run year, and Judge, and some of these other guys that were just hitting tons of home runs. None of them had more than two or three home runs on the first pitch of an at-bat. That stuck out to me, and my thought was, well, if I can find this, major league organizations, I hope, can find this out, and they stop throwing him a strike on the first pitch of an at-bat. And he hasn't hit over 10 home runs since in five seasons. Yes, one of those was the shortened 2020, but he was on pace for about 10 home runs that season as well. That's who he is for me. We're never going to see anywhere close to the 23 again. It took 648 plate appearances for him to get to 10 in 2023. I think that's the ceiling as far as power from Jeff McNeil. So we're looking at a high batting average, good amount of runs, and a decent amount of stolen bases, right? He could get to double digits as he did once again last year, got right to 10. So again, I think 10 and 10 is his ceiling. I really do. Good batting average, good runs scored. That's just, I think there's much more counting stat potential with Michael Massey hitting higher in the order, projected for twice as many home runs, getting into those double digits, and the same amount of stolen bases. So yes, Jeff McNeil, I would believe for the rest of the season, will have a better batting average. So his will come up and he may even surpass Massey as his drops a little bit. I think Jeff McNeil will have a better batting average, possibly score more runs. But I think the other three categories, without the two that I'm giving Jeff McNeil the advantage hurting us, I think Massey definitely has an advantage in the other three.
It's a really good point about which categories you need, because I think I agree with you that Jeff McNeil is the proven batting average player here. I think that we've seen Jeff McNeil post elite batting averages season after season. Last season was a bit of a down year for him, but he is a guy who can hit 300 and knows how to do it. And you know what they say over at Baseball HQ, like once a player has a skill, he owns it. And we have seen Jeff McNeil do that thing. Shelley, I wonder for you, is the McNeil-Massey decision more of a situational what do I need type of decision, or is it more about I trust that I have seen what Jeff McNeil has done before, and Michael Massey, this could be like the best month he has in his life, and then you get nothing?
Yeah, it's more of what I need. I will say that McNeil's position eligibility really does help, because I have found that I really need one, batting average help in a couple of my leagues. I got too much of Castellanos and, you know, Francisco Alvarez before he hurt his thumb. So, yeah, I'm like really hurting for batting average. So, yes, Jeff McNeil with his second base and outfield eligibility really helps me, especially on the waiver wire. But, yes, I agree with you, Kevin, that I really do think that Massey has like the higher ceiling. There is a point when it comes to like some players that I'm like, maybe I just want what I consider like a small room, maybe a small floor, a small ceiling, high floor, right? I want a very small room when it comes to like my MI. I think that both Massey and McNeil would be my MI if McNeil is not helping out with like some outfield help. So I'm cool with taking, quote unquote, like taking a category hit, but I know that I'm with McNeil, but I know that I'm going to at least get production from McNeil. With Massey, I don't know. Like there was like some rumors that the Royals were looking to get, who did the Royals? Yep. Arias. Yeah, they were looking to get Arias. Maybe they were looking to add him to the DH because they have kind of had like a really wonky DH situation. But it's like, if you're looking at Arias, you maybe would want him at second base. But again, like the Padres have been playing him at DH, so maybe it's just, it doesn't mean anything. But I don't know. It's just like, just give me McNeil. I know he's safe. He's not going to be a league winner for me, but at least I know what I'm going to get.
By the way, you mentioned Luis Arias, and one of the things that I found absolutely mystifying today is he is out of the lineup for the Padres today against Shota Imanaga, and I don't understand why. I'm like, I think I could be wrong. I don't remember if the Marlins faced Shota already or not, but I was kind of like, it seems like he, at least they've already played the Cubs. Like, I don't, anyway, that's neither here nor there. We should have a Luis Arias debate some other day. Kevin, my question for you, I think I agree that Massey is the high upside guy here. Like you can wish on what you might get out of Massey, but McNeil, as Shelley mentioned, is the high floor guy. At what point do you just want a floor guy rather than the upside?
I think this goes back to what you were talking earlier about what do I need and how am I doing in the categories for my team at the moment, right? Because the floor for Jeff McNeil is batting average and I would say probably runs scored as well. I would give him a nice floor there, but that's about it. So if it's not batting average I'm after, if I'm okay and run scored, then I'm going after the extra power and stolen bases here. That's kind of in general how I would think about it. Obviously, there are going to be some teams, and you know, we're a little over a month in now. Between 20 and 25% of our fantasy season is over. So our batting average and OBP, our ratios for our hitters are starting to get pretty well established, and it's going to be more difficult to move them. So if that is an issue for me, then I believe Jeff McNeil probably is the play in spite of the 231 batting average so far. I think he's the 300 hitter that we've seen for the past 5-6 years now. But I think that's where the what categories do I need come into play is when we're looking at floor. Later in the season, right, then when you have issues in categories, then we're forced to take more risk. Then I'm looking more at the upside. So if I'm already concerned about my batting average category, then McNeil is my play here. If I'm okay and I'm looking to pad my other counting stats, then I'm going Michael Massey, and that can change throughout the season as I will get more risky as the season goes on because we're forced to.
It's a great point about how we change our risk calculus throughout the season. I'm really glad you brought that up. Shelley, 1 minute rebuttal.
Yeah. Maybe I play differently than Kevin. I'm more of floor. And then when I need to get like really, really risky, then I'll go for the Michael Masseys. Give me the hot hand at that point. But I mean, with the amount of injuries and everything that is going on, just give me Jeff McNeil and we'll see.
All right, Kevin, back to you.
Yeah, I think the one other thing that I like about Michael Massey in the short term is the Royals schedule. He's not going to play against every left-handed pitcher. He'll probably play against some, but not going to against all of them. But the Royals play at least six, if not seven games every week until the week prior to the All-Star break. So for another 2 months, the Royals have at least six games, and I believe three of those weeks remaining after, not including this week that they have seven games, three more seven-game weeks prior to the All-Star break. So they have a really full schedule to pad those plate appearances for Massey.
Great debate, y'all. I'm sort of torn. I don't know who I would take at this moment in time. I can make a case for taking either one of these guys, and that's what we're here for. I think Shelley is moderating our last debate.
Yeah, so Jack Flaherty. I had him pretty much everywhere last year, and it totally blew up in my face and did not go well. And so I don't have him anywhere, and he basically is, instead of firing fastballs, he is firing fire emoji balls, right? Like, he is absolutely amazing this year. Except for a random, like, six-run outing against the A's, because baseball is funny, and we will always be wrong about baseball. But, anyway, Jack Flaherty, is this, like, can we trust this for the long term, or is this just like a hot month, hot 2 months? I don't know. I will go with Sarah. What do you think?
So this goes back to my guys leaving the Cardinals overperform their expectations theme that I love to return to on this show. No, seriously. Like, I actually think there's a lot you can believe in with Jack Flaherty, and it's easy to forget that in 2018, he put up a 2.75 ERA, and we were comparing some of what he did in the second half that season to all-time great pitching performances. Jack Flaherty is not your run of the mill. Like, I was just a dude and I got lucky one time. He was a top tier prospect who was supposed to do top tier things. And he dealt with injuries and issues along the way, and he wasn't able to actualize those results. I think we're seeing him actualize those results now with his new team in Detroit. And I think that what Jack Flaherty is doing is totally sustainable for a couple of reasons. As Shelley already mentioned, you know, you look at his pitches, he's got a 94 mile per hour four seam fastball. He mixes that with a slider that is elite. He's got a curveball he throws 78 miles per hour. He's got 86 mile per hour changeup. And every now and again, he'll just kind of mix things up with a sinker. And he's confusing hitters right now. He's doing things that are keeping hitters off balance. He plays all of his home games in a park that is designed to suppress offense. And I think he's feeling comfortable with a new organization that trusts him and trusts his stuff. I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibility that what we're seeing from Jack Flaherty is just him being his best self. And he wasn't able to access that over the last few seasons where things weren't breaking correctly. And no pun intended on the breaking there.
Yeah, I enjoyed his start against the Cardinals. I'm sure you did, Sarah. Like, he was feeling it. He was just like, let me show you what I have. It was revenge game at the highest point, even though he didn't win that game, which, like, really made me sad, because he needed to. He had 14 Ks and 6.2 innings. But, Kevin, all right, let's throw some cold water on Jack Flaherty. What you got?
So this is tough because I do not have Jack Flaherty anywhere. I haven't been a fan of his pretty much ever. And I am regretting that so far this season. So this may just be me trying to make myself feel better than actual good analysis of throwing cold water on Jack Flaherty. However, I can't help but look at the opponents, and especially in the strikeouts. And the strikeouts is where he's really excelling so far this season. The rest of his line, he's not getting us any wins. In fact, I don't think he has one. He's projected for 5 or 6 the rest of the season. His ERA is close to 4, which is fine if you're getting us wins and strikeouts. He is getting us the strikeouts so far. However, he had 7 at the Chicago White Sox, maybe the worst hitting team in baseball. He's faced Oakland. He faced Minnesota twice, and this is 2 to 3 weeks ago before Minnesota got hot and they were striking out a ton every single game. It was the horrible St. Louis Cardinals offense that we were just talking, that you just brought up, that when he had his 14 strikeouts. The only really impressive game for me as far as strikeouts go is his most recent start at Cleveland. Cleveland does not strike out, and a strikeout per inning is, I think, more impressive against Cleveland than those double-digit strikeout games he had against worse lineups. And so I'm really afraid that the only thing that's really positively influencing our fantasy teams right now is going to go away. And so I don't see anything here that really makes me as upset as I thought I would be about the fact that I don't have Jack Flaherty on any of my teams.
Yeah. So that it's a really interesting point, Kevin, when looking like deeper down into Flaherty's like game by game stats. Like, I haven't like really looked at the teams outside of, I looked at the highest earned runs and it was Oakland. And I said, lol, essentially. But yeah, it seems that he has been having like a little bit of a cupcake schedule. But again, like, he did strike out 6 against Cleveland. Does that give you any, do you think that there's something that he can build on from that? Like, he is going to be facing the Astros on Sunday. Do you think that he can keep up that strikeout rate, or you're just like, I still need to see more?
And Houston is another nice test as Cleveland was. Definitely more so than some of the others, in spite of how their offense has been performing. It has been better of late. And yeah, I think it would be similar to Cleveland. I'd be more impressed with a strikeout per inning versus the Astros than I am in some of the other numbers that I feel are a little inflated.
Yeah. So Sarah, with him facing some of like these cupcake teams, Minnesota twice, right? Before they really got hot, Chicago, Oakland, Tampa, Cardinals. Do you think that we should look at what he is doing differently? Or do you think, no, there is a tangible change and maybe we should believe in Jack Flaherty again?
So I'm not going to dispute the strength of schedule question. It's a great point. Although I don't think you strike out 14 guys against any team in Major League Baseball by accident. The thing that really jumps out to me with Jack Flaherty, and I honestly should have led with it and mentioned it before. Yes, Kevin is right about the fluctuating strikeout rate. The walk rate is pristine and elite. He is walking 3.5% of the batters he faces. That is new. His command is just off the charts good. And it's contributing to a couple of numbers that, look, you're right. His ERA is sitting right now at 3.86. He has been unlucky. Anytime a player is not getting the xERA or FIP he deserves, I am interested in being in on that player, not out on that player. His xERA his FIP right now is 2.98. His xERA is 2.99. That tells me that Jack Flaherty is actually getting unlucky at the moment. He's not performing as well as he should. And look, we talked about wins, y'all. I agree. He's not getting the wins. He plays for Detroit. What are you going to do? Every now and again, the Tigers are not going to score. But if you have a pitcher who's putting up a FIP under 3 while striking out double digit numbers over and over again, I think we should be in on that. And I only regret that I wasn't in on it because I've been so scared of Flaherty and the injuries for the last few seasons that I've been out on Flaherty for a couple of years. But we've seen this movie from him before. I think that this might just be Flaherty's breakout year, and maybe he has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder for not being part of the Cardinals anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I've loved to see. I'm glad you really did bring up the improved walk rate, Sarah, because that's something that I have noticed, and I'm like, that's definitely much improved from the last couple of years. But Kevin, we're going to go to rebuttals. Do you have a rebuttal?
Well, just the one thing that I haven't brought up, and I hate bringing it up. However, last season we saw 144 innings out of him. That was the only time we've seen him close to a full season in 5 years. So that's in the back of my mind as well. Every time he goes out there, I'm going to be worried because of his injury history. I think The 144 innings last season and 42 innings so far this season are great and do ease that concern some. But for a guy, even the shortened 2020, only 40 innings, and then 78 in 2021 and 36 in 2022, that is a bit concerning and something that we have to at least bring up. Even though I think once we get to this point, 186 innings over the past couple of seasons, we're probably more regressing toward league average injury risk, but only regressing towards it because the number one indicator of injury is previous injury. So that is still a bit worrisome.
Yeah. I totally forgot about all of his injuries. So that is a humongous point on your side, Kevin. Sarah, do you have a rebuttal?
I mean, I agree with Kevin on the injury front. Injuries are the reason that I was out on Flaherty this draft season. It had nothing to do with the underlying talent. I think that I've seen Flaherty at his best a lot when he's pitched at Wrigley Field. And it's nasty, man. Like, it's out of control. All I have to say is I wish past me would have been in on the Flaherty revenge season, because if he can stay healthy, this looks like a special season that he's got in the works here. And I am here for it.
Cannot wait.
These were some fun debates, y'all. Thank you so much for joining us. Kevin, we always end the show with a love it or leave it. One thing we're into from baseball this week or over, and you can kick us off as our guest.
I am so into this, and I was into it last year early in the season as well, when the Royals weren't one of the teams I could include in this list. But the Royals, the Tigers, the Nationals, they're all 500 or better right now, and we're a week into May. The Athletics and Pirates are very close to 500 in spite of what we saw the Athletics do on Tuesday. They looked more like the Athletics we expected this season on Tuesday, but they've been better than we expected. And it's at someone that can sit down, and it doesn't have to be the Royals, absolutely anybody, and watch anybody play. And sure, there's some players and teams I enjoy watching more than others, but baseball is just better when all of the teams are better. And if it's a Houston Astros that's struggling, that doesn't matter. Their fans are going to be there, and we know they're going to be back. You're right. They may not win the division. They may not even make the postseason, but they're going to get back close to 500 baseball. So we're seeing better baseball all around. And I just love it. It makes it so much more fun to watch.
I couldn't agree with you more. Better baseball benefits us all. And I, as a fan of a team who has kind of checked out early a couple of seasons after trading away a World Series core, it's a lot of fun when everybody is competing and trying to do the things. And I wish more teams would do that, because frankly, that's the whole point of the sport. Shelley, your thoughts on teams competing and or your love it or leave it?
Yeah, I agree. I will say some A's games the last weekend. So yeah, they have been very interesting. I really wish that I could watch Nationals games, but you know, blackout stuff really stinks. But maybe I can get my husband to go up to DC with me to catch a game. But yeah, it's really good to see some of the quote unquote who you thought was going to be bad teams just kind of play better than you expected. Yeah, that always makes you feel good.
Totally agree. And you're love it or leave it, Shelley.
Yeah. I will fully admit I am not a Star Wars fan. I have watched all the movies, right? But that is it. I don't watch any of the TV series or whatever. But I don't know if y'all saw Gunnar Henderson's custom Star Wars bat for like Star Wars Day. It was phenomenal. Like, it was basically based on a lightsaber. We have the red side, which is kind of like the bad guy side, and then like the blue side. It looks supremely, it's just so clean. It is phenomenal. And what I loved about it, one, it looks great. But then two, I am really excited that Major League Baseball is bringing back like Players Weekend. While we won't get like the nicknames on the back of the jerseys, which we know why, which makes me sad, but we're going to get like bats like this. We're going to get cleats that are just so much fun. And I cannot wait for Players Weekend just so we can just have some fun and just see some like really fire stuff.
Yeah, May the 4th is always a fun day for Major League Baseball. I did see that bat. I thought it was incredible. I am a Star Wars nerd, and it was good stuff. 10-10 recommend if you're a Star Wars and or Gunnar Henderson fan. What were you thinking about with Gunnar's bat, Kevin?
Oh, it was phenomenal. I love the handle, how it looks like it's got the controls on there that with the 3D perception. Absolutely loved it. Yes.
I'm going to go in a slightly different direction here, and I apologize. I keep bringing up Cubs stuff here, but every now and again, like I see a deep cut on Cubs things, and I have to share them with y'all. Dexter Fowler, who you may remember from leading off for the Chicago Cubs for the 2016 team, he was known as "You Go, We Go, Dex." That's what Joe Maddon would say to him, because when he started the game well, the Cubs usually started the game well. Dexter Fowler was drafted out of high school, and he made a promise to his parents that he would go back and get his degree. He graduated today from Penn State University, and I just think that's an incredible accomplishment to play a Major League Baseball career and to go back to college and get your degree after the fact is truly remarkable. I don't think we talk about some of the personal stuff with players that often in terms of the things they're doing outside of the sport. And Dex is just a really great dude. And I loved everything about this. So I saw that come across the feed today and I had to share it with you.
I love it. The only reason in my mind to do something like that is because of a promise you made to your mother. After you've made that kind of money and what you have to go through to accomplishment, yeah, cheers to him because he did that out of love. No doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I agree with Kevin, but it really is super nice. I definitely like if I had like a different career and I had to go back to school, I don't think I could do it currently with everything. So yeah, kudos to him. It's really awesome that he did that. I cannot imagine going back to school after a career. No thank you.
Right? Like after you won a world. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. When my wife first brought it up to me that she wanted to get her doctorate, and it really wouldn't affect her career much, but it was something she wanted to do. And I said, well, of course. She asked me if it was okay. Of course it's okay. You wouldn't have to ask me if it's okay. However, I don't understand why you want to put yourself through that. It's just not something I'd want to do.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. I mean, it's just human improvement, accomplishing stuff, like checking off the boxes. And I agree with both of you. I mean, it's a huge undertaking to go back and get your degree after all of that time. But props to Dex for doing it. And I do love that he kept his promise to his parents, even though he's a World Series champion, and he's got tons of money and he probably didn't need to do that, but he did it. And I think that's very cool. This has been a really fun show. Both of you are two of my favorite people in the industry, and I love chatting baseball every single week. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me and Shelly on this inaugural season of Fantasy Feud. Where can people find you? Where can they find your work? What are you working on?
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Go ahead.
Kevin first, then Shelly. Sorry, I might have said that backwards.
I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
No, yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I love these episodes. And yes, as I'm listening in my car, I debate along with you and your guest each week. I absolutely love it. So thank you again. I can be found over on the Pitcherless Podcast Network, co-host with Adam Howe, who does an amazing job, not with just with On the Wire, but as you know, Sarah and Shelly, with all of our Pitcherless podcasts. So shout out to him for that. And we have been recording on Friday evenings recently. We do record live on YouTube for those that want to catch us early, get a head start on their fab before Sunday evening. But Adam, make sure to get that episode out by 1 a.m. Sunday mornings for those that wait till Sunday to get started on their fab.
Adam does an amazing job and he takes care of this whole network in ways that I just can't even tell y'all. If you have not joined the live feed of On the Wire, you should. I hang out there every time I'm able to, and it's a great time. Adam and Kevin are super fun to listen to. They always have good guests and smart things going on. So definitely check that out. Shelly, what have you been up to? Where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at ShellyV_643. I've really been like going really diving into music. So there's been like a couple of albums that has come out the last couple of weeks that I've really been digging. So yeah, I've been really just digging into music more. And honestly, listening to music and watching baseball on mute is just absolutely amazing. You should try it out.
You know, I routinely will have baseball on in the background on mute with other stuff going on.
Yeah.
But unless it's like a Don Orsillo game or like a Pat Hughes game or something, it's like, I don't need to hear y'all. Like some of them are all-time greats and I have to hear them. But otherwise, I'll listen to something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it. You can find me at BCB_Sarah. There's no H on the Sarah. My Cubs writing is at Bleed Cubby Blue. My fantasy baseball writing is at Baseball HQ. And of course, you can find me every Wednesday at 1 o'clock in your podcast feed here on Fantasy Feud. Be sure that you follow the show at PL Fantasy Feud on the socials and leave us a 5-star review if you like us and you are listening so that we can help other people find the show. More debates coming at you next week.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.